Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's Friday, December 2nd, 2016. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Topics on today's edition include the ongoing, allegedly fraudulent, seemingly never-ending gubernatorial race, 2017 elections. We'll note the leading vote-getter from the general election last month, and what to drink when it gets cold outside. Back for continued pleasure in the hot seat is Jason DeBruin. J.D., holiday greetings, sir.
Yeah, it's maybe a little warm for holiday greetings, but nonetheless, good to see you.
It has cooled off today.
That's true.
Friday,
that's fair.
As we look at this, winter hat, gloves. Are you there yet?
No, absolutely not.
Not at all. Okay.
A little windbreaker, maybe. That's it.
Okay. We're going to start with a little game today. Needle or no needle? I want you to just tell me how things have registered for you. We'll begin with the McCrory Cooper race this week. The Republican-led State Board of Elections voted along party lines 3-2 to require a recount of about 94,000 ballots in Durham. The New York Times editorial board penned a scathing piece on the Republican incumbent, calling him North Carolina's sore loser, and the Democrat debuted his website, coopertransition.org. Which of these three developments moves the needle most for you?
Let me give a caveat. I don't really think any of them move the needle that much for me, in all honesty. If I'm going to choose one out of the three, it's probably setting up a transition team and essentially Cooper acting as though he is going to be governor. We're essentially positive that this is going to happen. That said, I have no issue with a candidate trying to use every avenue possible to make sure that all the votes were counted right, and if he's got a chance at maybe something overturning, wouldn't you want to pursue that angle? Excuse me. The interesting thing for this is that it's kind of made hypocrites out of a lot of people in North Carolina. You know, Democrats are calling Governor McCrory a sore loser, but then they look at what's happening in Wisconsin and are very much in support of a recount that might show a victory for Hillary Clinton up there. Conversely, you know, you have Republicans down here saying, hey, trust the process, respect the process. We got to see what happens in the Cooper-McCrory race, but then say that, you know, up in Wisconsin, it's ridiculous that anyone would order such a thing. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is just sort of part and parcel of a close race. We have a very close race, whether it's 9,000 or 11,000. I mean, it was a very close race, so respect the process of counting all the votes.
But to you said whoever is trailing or you know, candidates in this situation should do whatever they can to try to get victory. Where do you fall on alleging widespread fraud throughout the system?
Oh, no. Okay. Don't misunderstand me. I'm sorry about that. I'm not trying to suggest that there is widespread or any fraud. I mean, I think one thing that we learned with this election is that when it comes to voter fraud, the number is not in the tens or dozens, but the number is certainly not in the thousands either. I mean, you have people who cast a vote early and then die. Those votes should not be counted per our election law. You have people that cast provisional votes who potentially still have a record and they shouldn't have been counted, and you have people who accidentally vote in wrong precincts. I mean, these are things that happen, but they're in the number of some, you know, 2, 3, 4, 500. And when you're talking about a race of 4 million votes,
4.7 million votes,
4.7 million votes, it's incredibly tiny.
Right.
But I guess my point is that to say that it doesn't happen, and then somebody can show you 500 cases in which it does, I realize 500 compared to 4.2 million is a very small number, but it still isn't zero. So, you know, the process is what it is. The laws are in place to have a recount. If you don't want to have a candidate be able to challenge the election, then change the laws. But, I mean, the laws are what they are, so I don't really see a big deal in it.
Right. And we should note that at this point, the advantage for Cooper as we tape this is about 10,200 and some odd, which falls outside of the threshold for a mandatory state recount. So a recount might not happen. I think the concern for a lot of people, and trying to find nonpartisan folks at this point can be challenging, but some of the political scientists I've chatted with just talk about the danger of undermining. While there is not evidence of widespread fraud, you are undermining and you are hurting widespread confidence in the electoral process. And it's just a dangerous thing because there are not signs, there is not any kind of substantiation at this point that the race here or the presidential outcome in Wisconsin was flawed or tainted. And I think, and we've talked about this before, but one thing worth noting that is a little bit funny about all of it is you've got McCrory and McCrory's camp talking about problems across the state, more than half of the 100 counties, malfeasance and fraud and so on and so forth. At the same time, Donald Trump won by 170,000 votes. Richard Burr won by 6%. And you don't have, at least to this point, other prominent Republicans. And Senator Rucho did take stage front and center this week in front of the Board of Elections. But you haven't had any of those folks talking about some of the problems in North Carolina, real or perceived.
No question. And again, let me reiterate, I don't think that there's voter fraud. I think the evidence is quite clear that there is no such thing as widespread or even small-scale voter fraud at any level. But that being the case, wouldn't this just allow it to be proved out even more and sort of put the last nail in the coffin, if you will? Maybe that's a bad analogy, but the point being that it's going to hammer the results home even more. If you don't have a recount and you don't have you don't allow a candidate to challenge, then that same candidate or that candidate's party sure. could continue to raise questions, you know, really into infinity if they wanted to. But we have this opportunity for a candidate to say, hey, there was something that wasn't quite exactly the same, which is fair. In Durham, there were the problems with the counting machines. Again, don't let me suggest that anything wrong happened, but it is out of the ordinary from the other ones. And somebody is just coming behind and saying, hey, look, this was a little bit different. Maybe let's try to be cool about this and let's just recount them, check them, and make sure we got everything right.
Sure. And they will recount. I think it's about 94,000 votes in Durham County, many of which were early votes. Republican attorney Tom Stark, who filed the claim locally that was rejected by the Board of Elections and then brought it up to the state board. The state voted, as I mentioned earlier, 3-2 to do this recount in the coming days. That is expected to be done by Monday. Stark has said he doesn't expect any significant changes to come out of this. One thing that has been kicked around a little bit, I mean, in terms of solidifying and supporting and going to the third and fourth step to make sure these are accurate, the chairman of the Durham County Board of Elections, who is a Republican, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he has said one of his issues with how this has played out is that they have brought forth experts to demonstrate that there wasn't anything, there's no indication of widespread or substantial fraud in the instance in Durham. And the way I read his quote was he's concerned about having to prove over and over again that these are accurate results, and also just the precedent that this may or may not set.
Saying that he has to prove it over and over, how many times will it need to have been proved over again? I mean, we're talking about once, twice.
I think at this point it's going to be three or four, I think. Back to the needle. The needle, the total vote, what was counted in Durham, the tabulations have not changed more than a few votes from my right. understanding of it. I see both sides of it. I wonder about what kind of precedent it sets to be raising allegations or to be looking at every close race and if it's convenient for individuals to allege fraud, even if there really is no evidence of it. What are the long-term effects of that? I wonder.
Well, it's certainly bad, but I mean, it's bad in the sense that candidates are lying. I mean, I think that if every candidate is honest with him or herself, he or she would say there is no evidence of voter fraud. So if I'm perpetuating this lie, that's on me. But I mean, we see candidates do this since the beginning of time. Candidates lie all the time and spread fear and worry amongst the electorate all the time.
Sure.
So whose fault is it? I mean, it's no different than perpetuating a lie that President Obama wasn't born in the United States. I mean, there are things that people lie about all the time, and you know,
they have different kinds of effects. This one could, in theory, affect people from deciding whether or not they're going to go to the polls. But to your point, a lie about where the president, where he or she was born, is going to affect support for them. I mean, it's going to have a different kind of spider web.
I mean, if you're going to legislate out being able to lie, that's tough.
One of the things that we expect is that the legislature will make another run at changing voting law in the long session. To what extent We don't know. This remains to be seen. And this is, I'll own all of this right now. This is a personal theory, but I think that some of this, and we've seen other people chew the fat on it, but I think there is a legitimate thought that they're going to try to make changes again to election law, which they did 3 years ago when they mandated voter ID and they eliminated same-day registration and they reduced early voting. One of the things, this seems as though they're, creating a scene of chaos. They're creating legitimization to need to change these things because there is fraud. I wonder how this will play from a policy standpoint as potentially changes come again and as this goes back up through the courts, because General Assembly has some friends. The Republicans in power here have some friends. They do not have friends at the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond. And the body of that court has not changed. We still have an eight-justice U.S. Supreme Court. And while that's going to change at some point, probably not all that quickly. I wonder about what the end game is here and if it really is going to bring about any significant changes to state election law in the coming months or year, 18 months, something like that.
Well, certainly it's more concerning if there are laws that are changed that will actually in a physical way impair voting. I mean, being able to say that you think that there's voter fraud and having people actually believe it is far different from actually making legislation that reduces early voting sites, enacts voter ID laws, the list goes on. So if this has a direct result in affecting some of those laws, that is more concerning, no question. But, as you said, you have to look at who's in the courts as well, and these laws, if they get passed, will they be overturned at a higher level? Potentially so. So, I think that's a pretty long end game.
Meanwhile, a federal three-judge panel, not the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, but one of the judges that does serve in Richmond, ruled this week that 28 state legislative districts must be redrawn by March 15th of 2017. The judges had previously declared these seats racial gerrymanders, and the decision means state lawmakers, barring appeal, must act quickly in the early part of the legislative session that will convene in late January. Depending on the outcome of those possible appeals, this all signals that we will likely have another election for state legislative seats in 2017. Jason, what's the most significant part of this ruling this week, in your opinion?
Gosh, I don't know. Probably the most significant part is the redrawing of the districts. And if you're going to ask me, does this move the needle, where I was a little bit soft maybe and said the first one didn't move the needle that much for me, this one I'm redlining on. I mean, being told to redraw districts and having a special election is one of the most absolutely clear signals that the court could have possibly given that the election that happened here this year was unfair. I mean, I think a lot of people knew that there was going to be a new districts drawn, but then to mandate a special election so that you can actually have a fair election based on the districts as soon as is possible, including a special election that is going to be just physically difficult to carry out, I think is a major deal and a very important time in our history.
And to be fair, the elections that just happened, I believe the districts have been the same in 2014 and 2012. Mm-hmm. So this is the third time that we've seen these districts. It's worth noting that 28 districts have been determined racial gerrymanders. So the boundaries of those have to change. But naturally, if you change, the shape of Chapel Hill, it's going to affect the boundary of Durham or Cary or Pittsboro or Chatham. I mean, you change a puzzle piece,
exactly.
The other puzzle pieces change. So there was one legal brief filed a few months back by Senator Bob Rucho and House Representative David Lewis, and it estimated or indicated that as many as 116 of the 170 General Assembly seats are going to be affected by this. And with changing demographics and changing populations in the state, I mean, a lot of this stuff is done by computer at this point, but that's pretty drastic. That quick math, I mean, that's 2/3 of the seats, right, in the General Assembly could be affected by this.
No, absolutely. And I was studying the maps a little bit earlier today. If I can break it down, most or really all of the districts that are, say, west of Charlotte, so even Asheville and out in the western part of the states, will be left largely intact. In Charlotte, you got a few that are going to change, and in Raleigh, you got a few that are going to change. But then a lot of the changes are going to happen sort of in that central and eastern part of the state. And to your point, exactly. I mean, the districts that will need to be redrawn are very few of them actually touch each other. So exactly to your point, you know, if you, that one puzzle piece changes, everything around it will change as well. So I think it's fair to say that appreciably all of the districts that are in the central or eastern part of the state are going to be changed.
And the key there is, in the as I understand it, the suit that was brought by plaintiffs, much of this pertains to African Americans being packed in to districts, hence racial gerrymandering. There are more than 50% African Americans of the registered voters in a lot of these districts, I think in all 28. So perhaps what's going to happen is you're going to, I mean, in theory, I haven't looked at the computer programs, but they're going to redraw these districts so that there are African Americans are more evenly distributed across boundaries, which that's not what the Republicans want. And potentially that's, you know, advantageous for Democrats. I mean, is that an oversimplification of it?
I think that probably is an oversimplification in some ways, but in other ways, absolutely not. And I think it's worth repeating what the court ruled earlier this summer. And I'm reading here directly from the court's ruling. This sort of gives some background on how these legislative districts were first drawn. And it says that before, and again, I'm reading here directly from the court's ruling, before enacting the law, the legislature requested data on the use by race of a number of voting precincts. Upon receipt of that data, the General Assembly enacted legislation that restricted voting and registration in five different ways, all of which disproportionately affected African Americans. It goes on later to say that African Americans were targeted with, quote, almost surgical precision. I mean, I think it's worth hammering home the point that the people that drew these districts used data that they were able, population data, to, again here, quote, with surgical precision, draw such specific lines as to disenfranchise particularly African American voters. That cannot be understated. I mean, this is, in some ways, one of the more egregious things, in my opinion, that has ever happened, because everything flows downhill from here. You have, you know, the people that are now elected into office are elected through these specifically racially gerrymandered districts and then make laws for everybody in the entire state. So, you know, I think this is, it's in some ways too bad that the court ruled this. So this ruling that came down in the summer, in some ways it's too bad that they ruled it was too short of a turnaround time to have these new districts applied to the election we just had. But again, to restate what I said earlier, you know, to have a special election like this in an off year is, I mean, it's a big deal.
Elections will happen for all of the districts that are redrawn, as I read it, as I understand it. If there's a district in, for example, Davie County or Henderson County that is not touched, then that representative, that Senate member, will not have to run for re-election in 2017. The 2017 elections, again, this could get hung up on appeal. This could get overthrown. Recent history indicates that's probably not the case. So assuming there are 2017 elections, the winners will serve one term, and then they will run again in 2018, or those seats will be up for election again in 2018, and then there will be two-year terms. I'm interested, I guess, from a little more nuanced place in the weeds, how this affects the long legislative session, because lawmakers will come back in January, and, you know, number one objection is to pass a budget, but this becomes one of the early priorities for early in the session, and I wonder about, will this dampen, will this steer lawmakers away from any controversial legislation or some controversial legislation? And will it bring about an end to the legislative session any earlier? I tend to think that's not the case, but the court order that came out this week indicates that there will be primaries for these state legislative races in late August or early September. And state law indicates that you can't be in session and also actively raising money as part of a campaign, a re-election campaign. So there is going to be, to some extent, an impetus for these lawmakers to wrap up session and get out and try to defend those seats. As we saw, I mean, you've reported on the supermajorities in the House. The House maintained that supermajority just a few weeks ago. There were several close races, and there's no indication that there aren't going to be a handful of close races again next November.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not a question in there. I'm stating a few.
You're sure, right? I don't know if maybe I can bounce some data off of you. Being the data reporter, I like to look at some of this stuff. So, in the General Assembly, Republicans won 109 seats. That's 64% of the seats that are available. This is in the House and the Senate. If you total all the votes that they received, all Republicans versus all Democrats, they took only 54% of all those votes. So on a popular vote basis, all Republicans combined took just slightly more than half of all the votes, but they have 64% of all the seats. That's one of the effects of a gerrymander. In Congress, is even an even bigger split for a congressional representation up in Washington. North Carolina now has a 10-3 split, 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats. So that's 77%. There,
and when I moved here 10 years ago, it was an 8-5 Democrat to Republican split.
Yeah, and I've got some good data. We can talk about that in a minute, too, if you like. So they won 77% of the seats while taking just 53% of the total vote. So, I mean, here are the effects of what a gerrymander can have. Maybe
sure.
That's not a surprise to anybody.
But those numbers are important, and they're telling to an extent. But I also think we should note that there are other factors that skew those numbers.
That's
Phil Berger doesn't have an opponent. I mean, yes, Hillary Clinton won the popular by 2.5 million, but it wasn't a popular vote election. And some of the folks on the left have made way too much of that. If Donald Trump was running a popular vote campaign, he would have spent a lot more time in California.
Absolutely.
And New York, right?
No, and you make a fair point there, and there's no question about it. There's a story up on WNC.com if people would like to go check, .org, what am I talking about? WNC.org, if people would like to go check it out, I'll tweet it out again here later on today if you'd like. But this is a wider spread than we have seen in previous years. I compare it to other years. Absolutely, it does happen. The point you just made is very well made, and it's the correct one. But this is a wider spread than we've had in recent years. To the point you made a little while ago about if the long legislative session is going to end up being a little bit shorter, let me maybe ask from you a quick clarification question. If someone is not in session, but they intend to run, let's say a Democrat intends to run as a challenger, would that Democrat be allowed to campaign during the session?
Absolutely. If you want to campaign, yes is the short answer.
Because that could be interesting, because your point then is very well made. If it's June, July, and I'm, Democrat Joe Schmo, I'm out here campaigning in a district, and the sitting legislator is not allowed to campaign at all, that could really be a good impetus for that legislator to want to have the session end to get back to the district.
To your point, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if it is conceivable for state lawmakers to come in and say, hey, there will be no campaigning until August 15th or August 31st this year. They've tried crazier things than that. So I don't think there's any restriction on that. And I would suspect that some of these Democratic challengers that we saw in the House, maybe a couple in the Senate who tried to unseat incumbents a few weeks ago and were not successful, they may, depending on when the filing is, I mean, they may very well maintain a public presence, if you will, in the months to come. I mean, these aren't super big deal seats, and not a lot of people. These are seats that are very important, but these are not people that have great name recognition across the state. So I guess retreat on that a little bit. I don't think we're going to see, House challengers in February and March holding campaign events. But these are people who are going to do their best to be in the public eye. In the effort of time, I'm going to move things forward and just fire a couple of quick ones at you, as we tend to like to do here on the podcast. Again, our guest is Jason DeBruin, WNC's data reporter. We're chatting mostly politics here, which is, that makes sense on the WNC Politics podcast.
That's what we do.
Which candidate of all the candidates on the ballot last month received the most votes?
I know because we talked about it yesterday. Right, I don't know if that's fair or not. It's Steve Troxler. I think that's maybe it's one that you wouldn't necessarily immediately think of, but the more you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, he's very popular. People like going to the fair. It's just one of those where it's sort of not that surprising that somebody like him in a position where a lot of voters don't necessarily know much about what the position does, but they sort of associate it potentially with going to the fair or other positive events. I don't think it's really that surprising to see someone like him, who's frankly done a pretty good job, wouldn't you say? I don't know.
No third-party candidate either in this race to be North Carolina's agriculture commissioner. A post Troxler, I believe, is now held for 12 years. He's going to enter his fourth term. Troxler received 2.5 million votes. Here are the candidates who received more votes total than Donald Trump in November. Take this with a grain of salt, something to chew on. Richard Burr, U.S. Senator Dan Forrest, Lieutenant Governor Steve Troxler, Cherie Berry. I know, call her Sherry if you want, but Cherie Berry, Elaine Marshall, the only Democrat that I'm going to mention, Secretary of State, and Dale Falwell, the new state treasurer. So just something interesting to put out there. There are obviously other choices for president and libertarians. I don't know if there were any libertarian candidates for Council of State races. There might have been one, but that's part of the reason that those numbers get driven up. I saw a tweet within the last day or so. It comes from retired North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr, who tweeted out, CNN's campaign coverage was an embarrassment to the concept of legitimate news coverage, all hype, sensationalism, and partisanship. Jason, when was the last time you watched cable news for a minimum of 10 consecutive minutes?
Well, I guess election night. But before that, that's a great question. I don't know. I come from a print background. I am a major supporter of the print media. If you look at the news cycle, print drives the news cycle. Television and even Yes Radio follows that print-driven cycle. Print is the most important. Print is the best. Print is the most hard-hitting and factual. Cable news in particular does, in my opinion, tend to sensationalize a lot of things. They go after ratings. They go after things that are going to get people to tune in, and oftentimes, in my opinion, to the detriment of reporting good, solid, hard enterprise news pieces.
Cable television news in air quotes, is the scourge of American journalism. I don't really want to talk about it beyond that. It is not good for discourse. It has devolved into garbage. By and large, are there pockets and moments of goodness? Sure. But by and large, the 24-hour news cycle has eroded civil conversation. And just being open to understanding what the other side is about, or another perspective.
And I think it's too bad that people have gone, you know, that I think a growing number of people consume news through the cable news channels, and I think that's too bad. And if there's one thing that I can maybe ask the listeners of this podcast to please do is if you're at your house at night, please turn off CNN, turn off Fox News, turn off MSNBC, go to newsandobserver.com, go to newyorktimes.com, Washington Post, go to ProPublica. There are many, many news sites that do really good work and are driven by print journalists that are enterprising stories, giving you good factual information. Please stay away from the cable news. Focus on the print media.
One craft beer that you might be caught consuming in the next 24 hours. You're of legal age, if there was any question.
I am. I've long passed legal age. The Old Chub, the Oscar Blues Old Chub, is a good winter beer. That's one that I recommend.
I wouldn't recommend English ale, I believe.
Yeah, I wouldn't. It's nice and heavy. I think it's a stout, actually.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I'm wrong in saying that. I could be wrong. I am not a beer connoisseur, so if anybody would want to call me out at Jason DeBruin, at me and tell me how wrong I'm happy to listen. But the Oscar Blues Old Chub is one of my wintertime favorites. Don't recommend it for the summertime, but for the wintertime, it's pretty good.
Oscar Blues is a good one. They are from Lyons, Colorado, with a North Carolina outpost in Brevard, North Carolina. I'm a pinner guy myself. Oscar Blues Session IPA. We will leave it at that for now. Thanks for joining us on this latest edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. We will note quickly that WUNC is in the midst of a pledge drive. Independent journalism remains strong thanks to the support of tens of thousands of listeners of this station and some of the listeners of this podcast as well. You can make a pledge. It is tax deductible if you do it by the end of the year at WUNC.org or by calling 1-800-962-9862. As for this podcast, thank you again for listening. Please feel free to share it on Twitter, Facebook, word of mouth, maybe a group text. Find previous episodes of the podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Listen to the latest political news from around the state at our website, wunc.org. Enjoy your weekend. We'll chat again soon.